All right, so that's the economist's view in a nutshell about what is marriage. It's an institution that constrains. And so I want to talk very briefly about Canada's child support guidelines and what happens when you invoke a law based on good intentions when in fact people are opportunistic and are interested in themselves. I could have picked the no-fault divorce laws. I'm tired of talking about them. I could have picked other custody laws. Kind of tired of talking about them. This is just some recent work that I've been doing, and it's just come out in the Journal of Law and Economics and Organization. So prior to 1997 in Canada, we had child support was based on a court decision, based on the best interests of the child. So if there was a family in Toronto that were divorcing and they would go to courts, a judge would decide how much the child support would be. And if a different family was in Edmonton and they were getting divorced, a different judge would decide a different amount of child support based on the characteristics of those two families. One of the rallying cries for why we needed to reform our child support guidelines was people were saying, that family in Toronto got a different settlement than that family in Edmonton. And they both had two kids. Like, so what? I mean, they're living in two different cities. They could have totally different circumstances. You have no idea think of all the variables that would describe two families. Those are some things that the courts would take into account. But people are saying, no, we need consistent awards across the country. So that was one of the rallying cries. And the outcome was, in 97, we got what were called the guidelines. And the guidelines are just tables. And the tables only have two characteristics that have to describe every single family that's divorcing. And they're based on the number of children in the custodial home and the non-custodial parents' income. That's it. So if you have two families that have the same number of children in the custodial home and the same non-custodial income, they pay exactly the same child support, regardless of all the other dimensions in the family that could be different. Okay, so only two dimensions now describe families. The interesting thing about the guidelines, and the tragic thing about the guidelines, is that they pay more than the cost of the children. That they're designed, they have design flaws in them that end up overcompensating for the cost of children. Now you say, well, what's wrong with that? That sounds like a good thing. Children get more money. Well, the problem is that it implicitly amounts to an extra spousal award and encourages the custodial parent to divorce under certain circumstances. So what it does, it gives certain families a huge incentive to divorce. Compared to other families. So what are the four issues in the guideline creation? Well, one is they overestimate the cost of children. Two, the non-custodial parenting expenses are not included, which also lead to a bias in the custody payments. Three, of all things, the value of children is not considered. So children are not considered a good. They have no explanation for why we have them. They're just a bad. They're just something that's bad, and you have to compensate the person who has them. And then there's this incredible, what the economists call the black hole allowance, this thing that was tacked on the very last minute for extraordinary expenses, which also, all four of these things create a bias in the child support guidelines. So quickly, the cost of children. The formula uses something called the 40-30 rule, which was a crude innovation of Stats Canada in the early 1980s to try to design a cost function for welfare payments. It's designed to be applicable around incomes between $20,000 and $40,000 a year. The 40-30 rule is just a simple formula, 1.4 plus 0.3 times n minus 2, where n is the number of people in the household. So if n was equal to 2, 2 minus 2 is 0, so that means 1.4. That means a two-person household costs 40% more to run than a one-person household. So two don't live as cheaply as one. They live 40% more money. That's what it means to be equally well off. If n was 4, 4 minus 2 is 2. 2 times 0.3 is 0.6. 1.4 plus 0.6 is 2. So a four-person household is twice as expensive as a one-person household. Okay? That's sort of the economies of scale that are built into this formula. The thing to notice about it is it's just a straight line. It's just linear. And so, If here I picked a family of three. What this says is, so here's the 40-30 rule, this linear line here. If you had a family earning $100,000, a single person in a household with $100,000, then the 40-30 rule says a family of three would need $170,000 to be equally well off. Okay? And it's just a straight line. So the more money you make, you get this sort of linear expansion. Now, economists estimate these functions all the time. And here on this map, I've got a linear one that's drawn. When they do more complex ones, it's actually a concave function. It actually sort of falls off like this. But even with the linear estimation, you can still see what happens. There's a point where these things were designed, around $30,000, $40,000 a year, where it's not a bad rule. For really poor families, it does a bad job. It actually pays them too little. But for wealthy families, it pays too much. That the expenses of the household are not linear with income. They tail off. Think of all the various expenses you might have. Think of your food expenses, your housing expenses. As your income goes up, those expenses don't go up linearly, right? All right, so that's one problem. Now the problem is that formula is fed into this formula. So the guidelines say, okay, let's take the income of the non-custodial parent, divide by his expenses, and then we'll take the income of the custodial parent and we'll divide by their expenses, and we'll set those two things equal. And so what they do is, there's where the 40-30 rule comes in. And if that denominator is too big, then that makes the right-hand side too small, which means more money has to go in that direction. Now the other problem is this one. Here's the expenses of the non-custodial parent. By putting a 1 there, the guidelines treat a non-custodial parent as if that person was single. But think about it. If I'm a non-custodial, suppose I'm divorced, my wife has custody of the kids, I still have to have a bedroom for them to sleep in on the weekend. I still need to have a car that's got 5 seatbelts. I still have to have a refrigerator with food in them for eat that's more than mine. That maybe I don't have the same expenses as if they lived there full time, but my expenses are certainly higher than if I was just a bachelor. And so if this thing is too small, okay, this thing is too big, which means payments have to go more in that direction to make it equal. So the guidelines bias it on this side, and they bias it on that side. The other thing that they do is they only include income in the top. They don't include what economists would call utility. Now think about your own marriages and your own families. What do you get the most satisfaction and joy out of if they're over 20? Right? It's your children. Right? A big function of marriage is to have children. And children provide all kinds of satisfaction and joy in your life. But that joy and satisfaction is not included in the guidelines. And so when you only look at income, you're ignoring the value of children. And the custodial household gets the kids most of the time, which means they get most of the joy, right? So that means the numerator over here is too small, which means the right-hand side is too small, which means their payments have to be even larger on that side. So that's the value of the children. Okay, you got the wrong numerator. The black hole provision is sort of interesting. The guidelines were designed to take into account all expenses. At the last minute, somebody said, hey, what about orthodontic work? You know, I mean, that's extraordinary expense. Shouldn't we allow for some contingency for these extraordinary medical claims and all these sorts of things? And the answer was, okay, we did. So they tacked this on at the very end. And the way it works is that if there's an extraordinary expense, then the spouses share the expense in proportion with their incomes. So if they both make the same income, then the non-custodial parent pays 50% of the extraordinary expense. In other words, the non-custodial parent has to subsidize the extraordinary expenses of the custodial household. Now, there have been one court case after another about what counts as an extraordinary expense. Orthodontic work, yes. Medical expenses, yes. Hockey equipment, yes. Figure skates, yes. Piano lessons, yes. So it's gotten to the point where just about anything counts as an extraordinary expense, which means you have an enormous subsidy of the custodial household. All right, so what does that mean? Well, what it means is that if you're in a certain type of family, namely a family where you have high income but a single breadwinner, that family is at a huge jeopardy for divorce. Maybe it's a marginal marriage. Things aren't going very well. the potential custodial spouse can say, okay, I can leave, we'll split the marital assets, and I'll get this child support payment that actually is quite a large spousal support payment. I now have an incentive to divorce. I get the kids, I get many of the assets of the marriage, and I get this large spousal support. And so that's the incentive that it creates, and that's what I find. So if you have a good intentions view of marriage, you say, well, nothing should happen. People only divorce because the marriage is dead. But if you have the marriage as an institution approach, and everybody's greedy in the marriage, and we have to constrain that behavior, what you realize is the child support guidelines open the door to allow one spouse to behave opportunistically. And so that's what I find. I'm not going to go into the statistical work, but if you look at families with one income that are successful, right, so families that earn where the main breadwinner is earning more than $60,000 a year, those families have an increase in the divorce rate hazard. And the amazing thing is that $100,000 a year, it goes up by 10%, which doesn't sound like a large number, but you know that's a huge number actually for laws to have an impact on divorce. For example, the no-fault divorce revolution had an impact on average about 6 to 12%. Now, over time, that leads to lots of divorced families and all kinds of changes in our life. So having a change of 10% to this group is a big deal. And when you look at divorce rates for families with no kids, divorce rates with families with incomes around $40,000, it doesn't make that big of a deal. Okay, so that's just one example of when you make a law that doesn't take into account the fact that people can behave opportunistically, you end up with bad outcomes. Now, so, if marriage is an institution, then every element is there to constrain some type of behavior. Okay, it's not there accidentally. It's not there for one person to, hurt the other person. It's there for a reason, there to constrain some type of behavior. If you remove any of those constraints, then you can expect to get more of that bad behavior that you were socially trying to avoid to begin with. You introduce no-fault divorce laws. If you go back and read the literature in the 1960s, it should have made no difference to divorce rates. And yet, in Canada, we had a six-fold increase in the divorce rate within 2 years. Why is that? Because lots of people took advantage of that law and the various property laws at the time to steal wealth out of the marriage for their own private interests. Jennifer mentioned this recent StatCan report. So the StatCan report talks about how cohabitation is increasing, marriage is now the minority, etc., etc. Well, what would we expect? Since 1968 with the Divorce Act, we have had not a single piece of family legislation that's been pro-family. We have eroded the value of the legal side of marriage. We have given all the benefits of legal marriage to cohabitating couples and to others. We've extended the franchise now. I mean, what would we expect? People don't abandon marriage because there's still all those other elements that constrain us. But at the margin, we've eliminated a lot of the legal benefits to marriage. And so why shouldn't we expect that at the margin, people are not going to take up marriage? Because it's an unnatural thing. We don't want to be married, right? I mean, we want all the benefits, but we don't like the costs. And what I'd really like is everybody else to be married, and me, I get to have my own private arrangement. That's what we'd sort of like. But that's why we have marriage to begin with, because it constrains me my private behavior. You know, society has a big problem. Society needs babies, right? Babies need mothers and fathers. And what have we done in our culture? We have a huge fertility crisis. Not enough babies. Canada, one of the lowest fertility rates in the Western world. Half of us, will be gone in 50 years. Of the babies that are being born, record numbers in single-parent families, out-of-wedlock births, etc. How did we get it so backwards? We got it so backwards, I think, because we have the wrong theory of marriage. We don't view marriage as an institution, as a constraint, to make us behave well, even though we privately don't always want to. Okay, so I think that's it. Okay, it's been around a few thousand years. Maybe it's doing something right. We should have a little more respect for an institution that's lasted so long. That's it. Thanks.
I think, unfortunately, we haven't left as much time as we should have for questions, but there is time for, say, one or two before we get our lunch and move on to the next speaker. If anybody has a question, then come on up. Patricia Morgan, would you like to speak into the mic, though?
Okay. I just wanted to ask here that you say there's not been one piece of pro-marriage legislation say, from the UK, no pro-family legislation since the 60s. Not just legislation, but the economic foundations of marriage have also been obliterated. But what you keep hearing from people is what I call the trial by ordeal. They say, well, you shouldn't expect any benefits. You know, marriage is worthless if you don't, you know, if you expect to have any legal protection, if you expect to have any economic advantage. I'm playing devil's advocate here. What do you think of that?
I guess I would totally disagree with that.
Yeah, I know.
So again, my view of marriage is you've got two people coming together. They come together because they realize that over their lifetime, there's benefits to procreating. They want to procreate. Either for they're hardwired to procreate or they want to have children. And then you say, okay, we want to have children, but that's going to raise all kinds of problems. For example, women have to heavily invest in making children. Men don't. So we know that, and they have to invest up front. We know that leads to a contracting problem. Women invest up front, men get the children, and then they abandon their family. There's the breeding up issue, right? So wives might have to settle with a certain male as a husband, but they can have sex with a higher quality male on the side. The husband might not find out about it. He ends up raising somebody else's children. So there's all kinds of problems that arise over this thing. We've designed the institution to protect and solve some of those problems. Now you're saying, why don't we just privately do this? Well, because there are better ways than to do it privately. We can't privately solve a lot of problems. For the same reason why Jennifer's talking this morning, cohabitating couples cannot solve a lot of these problems that require larger institutions to solve.
And as to the thing you mentioned about the male in the family raising somebody else's seed, stats or research has looked said it's anywhere from 20% to 40%. So this is a significant advantage of marriage to protect these children from wherever the seed came from. But in your work, have you looked at the impact of what came in with the child support guidelines? Of course, was the flipping child support from being taxable in the hands of the recipient to not. And we all know that, you know, a tax-free dollar is worth about a buck and a half that you have to pay taxes on. Have you looked at the impact of that? Because that has twisted a lot of things as well, that non-taxable income isn't counted for social benefits, isn't counted for any number of other wealth-sharing devices from the government. So I would think that would be another huge incentive to divorce again.
Yeah. I personally have not looked into that, but others have. The argument for that is that, you know, the payments themselves are supposed to be adjusted to account for that. And of course, you know, maybe for the average family at $40,000 a year, it might have been the case. But the problem with the guidelines, of course, is nobody's the average person or the average family. And so, my guess is it probably has made a difference, but I haven't looked at that. Who drew up the guidelines? Well, it was the Department of Justice in Ottawa. And maybe over lunch I can talk to you about that. There's an interesting political economy story there that the economists in the room that were objecting to these things saying, you know what, maybe you're changing the incentives, and maybe they were all fired. So I think there's a big story to be told there. But.
And to add to that, with the extraordinary expenses, Justice Canada basically would not part with the building blocks, information for the guidelines for about a year and a half to 2 years afterwards, so that when the cases hit the courts and the judges had to make the decisions about what was an extraordinary expense and what not, they had no access to the original building blocks, so they couldn't tell. So of course they erred on the side of, oh, everything's an extraordinary expense, thus setting the precedence in the courts. So certainly there is many elements of this that upon research you have to really wonder about the good work by Justice Canada, because this certainly was not based in economics by any means.
Doug, mine's a short question because I know we're anxious for lunch. But so what would you prefer then? Is that improved guidelines or greater discretion on the part of family?
I honestly don't see what was wrong with the old system. Every family is different and unique in certain dimensions. Some kids require more expenses than others. What was wrong with the judge? The best interest of the child's doctrine.
I think I'm kind of glad to hear you say that, because so much of our emphasis is taking away judgment discretion from our judges. So it's a novel and somewhat contrary point of view. So thank you.
I would like to take this moment to thank Dr. Doug Allen for his fascinating speech. Thank you very much.